Okay, thank you, John. Just to very quickly introduce, this is John Hibbert. John is a founder and director of Barry & Hibbert. He is a graduate in economics and accounting and then operational research. He's over 25 years' experience in the life insurance, asset management and security industries. Before founding Barry & Hibbert in 1995, John led the equity quantitative research team at a major investment bank. He was responsible for the development of Barry & Hibbert's economic scenario generator business and now has overall responsibility for the technical activities of the firm. John's still involved in a wide range of research and consulting activities, as well as serving as a board director. And in August 2008, John was appointed an honorary professor in the School of Mathematical and Computer Sciences at Heriot Watt University. And he also taught me everything I know. Enjoy. There'll be plenty of time for questions at the end.
Thanks, Craig. Hopefully everyone can hear. I'm going to aim to speak for about half an hour and leave us some time for discussion, but it's a sufficiently small group that I think, you know, feel free to stick your hand up if you've got comments or points of clarification, and maybe we can just make the whole session sort of fairly interactive as we run through it. Okay, market consistent pricing. This is a terribly unappealing title that I've got when I saw the rest of the conference. Very briefly on this overarching theme of renovation of the financial system, I think one kind of major theme that we should all be aware of as economists or actuaries is this fundamental change that's happened and happening in the way in which insurance firms think about value on the balance sheet and the way in which they set capital, and the move over the last 10 years at different speeds in different parts of the world towards risk-based measures of capital. Of course, yesterday we've got a new set of standards in Australia published by APRA, which incorporate many of the kind of themes that we're seeing in Solvency II and the capital regimes that have emerged in other parts of the world over the last 5 to 8 years. And indeed, one of the reasons my firm is so heavily involved in this type of work is we started life on the doorstep of probably the world's most aggressive insurance regulator in terms of applying these market consistent ideas to valuing complicated insurance liabilities and the capital measures that go alongside them. So this is a piece of renovation that I suppose I view that has been going on for a number of years, but it's no less important to make these ideas effective and useful for firms than at any point even before the GFC. I've learnt a new acronym since coming to Australia. Okay, so let's have a quick look at my agenda then. So I'd like to spend a little bit of time on just highlighting why at least the arguments in favour of market consistency and why both regulators and firms and other interested parties, rating agencies and investors, are attracted to these ideas, and then some of the challenges that arise in implementation of what in principle is a kind of straightforward, economic, intuitive idea. I'm specifically going to look at yield curves and, if you like, the simplest valuation problem that actuaries have, placing a value today on known cash flows in the future. If you like, obligations to make payments to customers, how do we place an economic value on those today? And some parts of the answer to that question are relatively straightforward, others more complex, and we'll explore that both in terms of what I'm referring to as extension of yield curves, but also what has been enormously topical in the kind of debate among regulators in setting sort of valuation and solvency standards in Europe, and it also crops up in APRA's discussion paper on capital standards, which is the way in which the price of liquidity and liquidity effects in asset markets impinge on market consistent valuations. I'll touch on options partly because they were in my title at the end if there's sufficient time, although the sort of principles we'll draw out for other asset types equally apply to options markets. Motivations I think I'm no deep expert in Australian financial markets and financial products, but there are very clearly both kind of legacy products with some complex guarantees and options for policyholders, and potentially in the future. And if we look, stand back and look at this, a recurring theme through the conference has been this substantial risk that individuals are carrying in superannuation and long-term financial planning problems, and the scope of the industry through variable annuity products and other types of products which embed guarantees and effectively create security for the industry to, if you like, price and manage and if possibly hedge or bear those risks and ensure they have sufficient capital to meet them. All of these ideas are important building blocks in building kind of coherent, robust analysis for firms. Okay, so let's start with. Let's start with the first question. What does market consistency and fair valuations, economic values, what's on offer? I mean, the basic kind of rationale that this has been used by proponents of market consistent valuation is that we're bringing much closer alignment to measures of, if you like, economic value with the valuations that apply in financial statements and regulatory measures of market valuation. And as a consequence, we'll get a better alignment between, if you like, the fair economic capital based on the risks that shareholders carry as a consequence of the promises that firms make, better alignment with economic capital with solvency measures which are delivered as a result of regulation. Should encourage, more rational economic pricing of financial products and, again, complex guarantees such as variable annuity products, bringing those onto, if you like, those understanding the economic manufacturing costs of guarantees and ensuring firms are creating value for shareholders rather than destroying it by selling, if you like, a complex financial claim at the wrong price. So a better understanding of value, also a better understanding of risk exposures. And ultimately, and I think, I mean, if you looked at the UK framework, as I said, one of the sort of foundations or first movers in terms of regulation and market consistency, I think if you and it's been at times over the last 7 or 8 years the implementation of market consistent realistic valuation and risk based capital has been pretty ugly and messy. But I think if you applied that sort of acid test and asked the regulator, do firms have a better understanding of the risk exposures on their balance sheets, and as a consequence, do we see better risk management action by firms as a consequence of that understanding, the regulators would say absolutely yes. Okay. And two quite distinct types of problem firms are concerned with. What's a financial claim worth, which will be our focus over the next 20 minutes or so, and then questions around capital. Okay, but before I move on in a little more detail, I'd like to make just a few comments about markets themselves. So when we talk about markets and market prices, what is it that is driving those prices? And I think it's important just to take a step back and maybe read this slide, and then we'll park these thoughts. But a lot of the kind of discomfort among both regulators and users of fair values, I think certainly post-2008, has been as a kind of realisation of there are some things in market prices that actually cause a lot of variation and movement that we're not necessarily that comfortable with, and maybe less comfortable transferring onto the balance sheet of a long-term financial institution through market consistency. So when we think about movements in asset prices, there are factors that actuaries and accountants and economists are going to be comfortable with. When we look at all assets, there's some set of future expected cash flows generated. for a government bond, those may be well known and extremely reliable. For corporate bonds, there'll be some credit risk associated with those. For equity dividend streams, there'll be risk around the state of the economy, the profitability of the corporate sector, and equally for real estate markets. But the other side to that are changes in the way those income streams are valued, so changes in the way they're discounted. And underlying all these cash flows, we have risk-free term structures, or think of in terms of maybe real and both nominal term structures for valuing different types of cash flows, and also variation in the price of risk. So if you like the equity risk premium, call it fear and greed and animal spirits, the if you like, the price of risk that is demanded by investors to bear risk itself can vary significantly through time. And I think this variation in the price of risk can also be an important source of variation in asset prices. Now, of course, as we've seen over the last few years, the level of risk can move around as well. So in environments where, if you like, the magnitude of risk faced by investors is elevated compared to normal levels, even if you like, the price per unit of risk might be unchanged, there may be very different risk levels faced through time. So movements in risk premia may be important in asset pricing. And there are other little knotty mathematical effects, convexity effects in fixed income markets. Effectively, I mean, if we just increase the level of risk in interest rate uncertainty, that has an effect on the long end of the bond market through these little mathematical convexity effects. Also, there are other kind of factors driving market prices, and I think financial economists would argue both the level and the price of liquidity appears to be an important source of important component of market prices. So there are some assets where we're going to see if you like, the level of liquidity in asset markets falls, and maybe the price that investors attribute to high liquidity changes, that may also have a significant impact on certain types of asset as well. And there are other asset premia. If we kind of broadly think of these as asset premia floating around as well, volatility risk in options markets, currency risk may also have specific risk premia associated with it. So when we think about these problems, as a kind of stand back as a financial economist, I think it's important to understand that there are many sources of movement in prices which will underlie any market consistent valuation. Okay. What do regulators and accountants have to say about missing market prices? There are a number of different regulatory views. Here's a fairly useful and typical example. The international accounting standards and, the, if you like, the US accounting standards the international accounting standards are essentially a collaboration between the Financial Accounting Standards Board in the US and the International Accounting Standards Board. And they're thinking about fair fair valuation, actually provide a clear distinction between three levels of valuation. One where we have market prices for some cash flow or instrument in active markets, where there's, and I'll come on to active markets, but I guess we can observe significant liquidity and trading activity in those instruments. There's then a level in fair valuations where we create a model-based price, an estimate of where an instrument would trade, but that price is largely based on inputs that are observable in deep and liquid or deep active markets. And there's a third level where we're using models to make an estimate of fair value, but the inputs into those models are unobservable. They're based on analytical judgment, and there may be substantial uncertainty about those judgments. So that different firms may arrive at quite different valuations for similar types of cash flows. In the slide pack on the website, there are some additional slides on accountants and regulation. Okay, let's look specifically at the yield curve and how these ideas might apply to the yield curve. This is an area in which my firm's done a lot of work. I mean, the core of our business, as Craig said, is stochastic projection of uncertainty for this twin valuation and risk management purposes. But I've found myself in Asia over the last 2 years spending far more time talking about these even more fundamental questions, which is how do we simply value fixed cash flows? How do we manage the kind of yield curve component of valuation, and what's the price of liquidity? Should that be incorporated in valuations? And if so, how do we do that in a coherent and justifiable way? So with the yield curve, I guess it's a sort of straightforward problem in the sense that in some highly developed economies, we will have fixed income cash flows trading out to 50 years. We may have long-term government bonds. There are some 50-year government bonds in issue in a number of well-developed markets, and there may be swap market quotations out to similar maturities. Excuse me. But in many markets, these instruments don't exist, in particular in smaller markets. I think in Australia, we've got government bonds to... So is it sort of 10 to 12 years, swap quotations somewhat longer than that. So there is a very natural question. If cash flows, if you like, known cash flows fall beyond the maturity of these traded instruments, how do we extend the yield curve? And in other words, how do we apply a market-consistent valuation to these cash flows? In some markets, we may actually have simply have a short-term rate and no bond market at all. okay, so here's a kind of flavour for the problem in a sort of visual fashion. So what is plotted here out to 30 years is US dollar yield curves over a period from 1985 to 2007. Now, we've plotted here in terms of the forward rate. You like to think of the forward interest rate as a sort of fundamental building block in the yield curve. We can use forward rates to build zero coupon rates or par yield curves. In other words, the yields on bonds that trade at par, which is essentially the way that swap contracts are quoted. But we work with forward rates because they're like the little building blocks that we can build all yield curves from. We have information out to 30 years, and in this case we have an extrapolation, and it's one of the methods that has been proposed for extrapolating yield curves in the past, which is simply to assume that beyond the longest maturity we assume a constant forward rate. And other kind of, if you like, simple, kind of maybe superficially appealing alternatives might be just to assume the spot rate is constant. And we can see the impact of that assumption out to some very long maturities. Different parts of the world will face cash flow profiles of different maturities. But in some countries, this is a kind of major problem with significant cash flows beyond the longest traded maturity. Now, what's the problem here? Well, hopefully it's reasonably obvious that... The if you like, the extrapolated part of these yield curves is extremely volatile. We're transmitting all the variation that we see in the longest instrument and the longest forward rate right across the extrapolated curve. And if we think about, I've called this a discount bond volatility, essentially what we're measuring is the variation in the price or the value we place today on a dollar 1 year or 10 years or 50 years in the future. And what this chart suggests is that if we extrapolate in this simple way with fixed forward rates, we generate extraordinary volatility in the variation of the values of long term cash flows. Probably won't get too hung up on individual numbers here. We have some research notes available on our website, which provide more commentary around this table and the sort of analysis. So, what is it we've proposed to do? And I mean, this is work we do for insurance and pensions groups. It's also very similar to where European regulators, after a rather lively debate over the last 6 months, have ended up in terms of extrapolation methods. There are some differences, but the principles that I think are now being followed are very similar. The basic idea is, if we look in the sort of bottom left-hand corner, we have some market information. In this case, we've got market rates available to about 10 years. Importantly, we're going to set a long-term limiting assumption for forward rates at some very long-term horizon. I'm calling it an unconditional assumption here. This is going to be either fixed or extremely slow moving, and will provide an anchor, in terms of ultimate assumptions about forward rates. And then we need to join up the market information with this long-term limiting assumption. So the questions that naturally arise are, well, where's the longest market forward rate and what is it? And that turns out to be quite a messy problem, because actually estimating forward rates is extremely sensitive to tiny changes in bond prices. So there are some nasty technical problems associated with figuring out what that longest forward rate really is. How do we set the limiting long-term rate is, I guess, the next hard question. And then this path, do we reach it very quickly over the space of 10 or 20 years, or very slowly, potentially even more slowly than I've drawn in this diagram? And I guess in the limit, if it's infinitely slowly, then we're back to our approach of using something very close to a fixed forward rate. Okay, I really did lighten up my slides, didn't I? Let me outline. In the full pack of slides, there's more detail on how we answer these three questions. Essentially, given this sensitivity of the longest forward rate to bond prices, we apply some smoothing at the end of the market curve to ensure it behaves in what we view as a plausible way. The long-term limit is set using economic assumptions. So the kind of four components of a long-term forward rate essentially are very long-term inflation expectations, expectations about real short-term interest rates, and think in terms of an ultra-long horizon here. Any risk premium embedded into the yield curve also sits within a long-term forward rate. And there is this little technical convexity effect that I touched on a few minutes ago, which means that forward rates don't just reflect expectations, they also are influenced by uncertainty itself. And these limiting rates that we've set in our work essentially are we're working with real rates calibrated to a very long-term experience across many economies, around 1.8%, inflation rates of a little over 2%, a risk premium of the order of 1 to 1.5%, and a convexity adjustment of about 40 basis points. And that adds up to an unconditional forward rate assumption of a little over 5%. There's some interesting questions around the risk premium and how the risk premium should feature in insurance valuations. And it's an assumption we apply on a global basis. And our argument is, I simply am not confident about saying something about the unconditional inflation associated with the US dollar or the Eurozone or some other economy. We're talking here about 100 years or more ahead. So we adopt a single global view. And I think, unless you think about the pathological examples of Switzerland versus Zimbabwe, I find it very hard to justify differences on a kind of unconditional view of the level of either interest rates or inflation. The other kind of really hard question here is this speed of movement. And what we've done is looked at the decay that we observe in forward rate volatility in markets where we do have information on forward rates to long horizons. And that we believe that forward rate volatility decay gives us information on how quickly we should move our market information to this unconditional view. Okay, so Craig, if I aim to wrap up within the next 5 or 10 minutes, will that work for us? Okay, let's talk briefly about the liquidity premium. Now, hopefully this is a familiar idea. The basic idea when we talk about a liquidity premium is the idea that financial instruments which offer identical cash flows can sell at a different price as a result of their liquidity. If you like, investors are willing to pay a premium for investors that are cheap and efficient to trade. Either the depth of markets in those instruments is higher, or the impact of trading those instruments is higher. So if we think in terms of two imaginary government bonds, one of which has a tiny spread or close to no spread, and the other where there is a significant spread and maybe potential impact costs for larger trades, it turns out, and there's plenty of empirical evidence to support the proposition, that those bonds will trade at different prices. This is it a liquidity premium or a liquidity premium? All depends on whether we're talking in terms of prices or yields. If we think in terms of prices, we'll say liquid assets sell at a premium. There'll be a discount for liquidity in price terms, so it's a liquidity premium. If we think in terms of yields, it's flipped on its head, and you hear both these terms used, and frankly, they mean exactly the same thing. Now, importantly, from a kind of economic point of view and an actuarial point of view, thinking about valuation and market-consistent valuation, what are the implications? Well, the implications are, if we have cash flows that are absolutely known and fixed, and we have a choice between two matching bond assets, one of which offers us liquidity and the other which is cheaper and is illiquid, which, if you like, is the cheapest match for a cash flow. And where there is no need to access liquidity, the argument is, if we can match with that illiquid bond, then that's the right replicating market-consistent cost, market-consistent value for the illiquid cash flow. Now, as you may be aware, there's been a very lively discussion and debate among European firms and European regulators who had knocked back the idea of a liquidity premium towards the autumn of last year, and then knocked back the industry's response to that. There's been a fairly lively discussion between firms, the EU Commission, and a task force that was set up just before Christmas, and liquidity premium has been allowed back into Solvency II technical provisions for certain types of business. I see in the APRA's paper yesterday there is a recognition and they're opening the door to the use of liquidity premium for, I think, just for annuity business. So they appear to have actually narrowed down their view, in fact more narrow than Europe, on where this liquidity premium might reasonably be applied in valuations, but are asking for a kind of hard, tough, convincing analysis to demonstrate that these liquidity premium are there, and presumably that they can be accessed by firms. There's also and one of the arguments of the industry, and this was UK firms in particular with big annuity business backed by corporate bonds, and some of the Scandinavian countries, was I think they were acutely aware of how their portfolios behaved through the global financial crisis, where we had a dramatic fall in corporate bond values, dramatic widening in spreads. Now, the way those are currently valued, they can take that increased discount rate and also apply at least some part of that to liabilities. The draft regulations last summer were asking them to effectively, were they to choose to continue to hold corporate bonds but value their liabilities on the basis of AAA government bond yields, would have been a brutal environment for annuity providers. And they've looked for, I think, what they view as avoiding a pro-cyclical feature of valuation, in that as corporate bond values fall, allowing the liquidity premium into valuations allows the value of liabilities also to be marked down. And that's entirely reasonable if you believe that part of what those reduced corporate bond values are doing is offering a higher price for liquidity. Now, of course, one of the significant challenges is unravelling that liquidity premium and observing it. Now, there's a vast amount of literature on liquidity effects in capital markets across many different asset types and periods of time, literally hundreds of papers generated by the academic profession. Really, if you have the time, quite an interesting read. We've produced a sort of summary survey of the academic research, which we published last year. If we focus for a minute on corporate bonds, which, if you like, one of a number of potentially illiquid asset classes where liquidity premium may be on offer, it's worth, I guess, a quick reminder of what do we think makes up market spreads, and where does the liquidity premium fit into that? And I think it's important when we analyse corporate bond markets to remember there are a number of components to spreads. And we kind of think of spreads as being comprised of three pieces. This diagram's not drawn to scale, but to keep it simple, I think they're all at least meant to be the same size here. So when we look at a corporate bond spread, there's a piece to do with expected losses through default. We should, if we're bearing that risk, get compensated for it through some sort of risk premium. And that's certainly not something firms, annuity providers, or anyone else should be giving away to customers, because it's there as a payment for risk. And there's a third component, a liquidity component, which annuity providers have kind of argued they can use to match assets, and it's fair in terms of fair value terms to use that. So how might we unravel these components of bond spreads? Now, again, I don't expect people to read these diagrams from the floor, but in the work that has been done by firms, and we've been quite heavily involved in work for industry groups and the task force, there are a number of different methods being applied to delivering liquidity premium estimates. One involves taking corporate bonds and removing the credit risk by buying effectively insurance through the credit default swap market, and then measuring the spread on an insured portfolio relative to some risk-free alternative like government or swaps. You call these diagrams compare swaps. And the top diagram shows some estimates of those calculations. Now, those calculations they're useful, but there are kind of some significant issues associated with implementation. The second approach, which is something we've used for a number of years at my firm, also has been applied by the Bank of England to the sterling markets, is to use an option-based approach to thinking about, the cost of default by understanding firm values, market-based measures of firm volatility, the distance to default implied by different rating categories, and attempting to calculate a fair spread using an options model. There's a Merton model that's been around for many decades, and these approaches make use of the Merton model to estimate a fair spread. Now, that fair spread makes no allowance for liquidity, so essentially what the model is doing is saying we've got a fair spread based on Merton, we have an observed spread from the markets, and that difference is an estimate of the liquidity premium. And the middle diagram shows some estimates. Probably the most important thing to understand about this diagram is the left-hand side is 2005. This is the onset of the global financial crisis. So you see the big elevation for both those measures through the GFC. And the final idea is to take pairs of assets which we believe have identical economic characteristics, but different levels of liquidity, and compare their prices or yields. And there are calculations here based on covered bond markets, covered bonds and covered bond pools, which have some very, very high levels of security associated with them, comparing those to government bond and swap markets. And there's also some carrot comparisons looking at different types of covered bond, some very, very large liquid issues relative to less liquid issues, and how those spreads vary through time as well. Now, none of these methods are ideal. They're all subject to kind of estimation error and criticism, but they all do point in a similar direction. We get a kind of fairly consistent message across different estimation methods. And what I think the industry has proposed is to use, I guess, some fairly simple proxies, transformations of the spread itself, which have been calibrated to looking at all of these different methods over a period of time. I think I'm going to leave a bit of time for discussion. The final topic is around applying the same ideas, the estimation and extension of assumptions around option pricing, and if you like, fair option prices at maturities beyond which markets trade instruments. Now, the kind of framework we use is built in exactly the same spirit as what we discussed with yield curves. The idea that there are some limiting very long-term assumptions anchored with economic values. Now, with options, we need to be very careful in applying appropriate levels of, if you like, risk premium and risk adjustment. But essentially, we create these long-term anchors and then work from what we can observe within markets and impose structure on those extrapolations using a model. There are some slides included in the pack on the options market. But if I finish up now, maybe there's a time for some questions and discussion. I mean, the bottom line, I think we strongly believe, and we would, wouldn't we? We're in the business of delivering these sorts of analyses. But I genuinely believe that market consistency brings real economic benefits to valuation thinking and capital assessment thinking, and that is being recognised as Solvency II type regimes and risk-based capital regimes are kind of rolled out worldwide. I have to say, as an aside, Solvency II is a bit of a mess at the moment, and I think what we see in Asia, which is regulators just standing back, watching, and then hopefully picking the parts that work and ignoring some of the things that Europeans have created some problems for ourselves with the process of building Solvency II. But I think there are real benefits there to be had. I mean, it's clearly the theme that runs through the APRA discussion paper. There are significant technical challenges in applying these ideas. The idea that market consistency and market consistent valuation is simply about collecting some market prices, calibrating a model, and you're home and dry. The reality is actually very different. Actuarial judgment, economic judgment is still a fundamental part of this type of work, which might sound a bit odd given that the whole kind of rationale for market consistency is sometimes presenting it as being far more objective and rational than past actuarial judgments. So there's a real challenge here, and it demands an understanding of the economics, and I think a continued debate about how to effectively apply these ideas. Okay, I think that's all I've.
Okay, thank you, John. As usual, if you could just say your name and your question into the microphone.
Hi, William Milner. As I saw on the graph, I think a lot of the UK yield curves are inverted, particularly when you go to the long end. Does that imply, I think you were saying that if you go out 100 years, you have your, come what you call it, but your level you get to. Are you implying the levels below where the current yield curves are, or how do you explain the inversion? And would, as you go out, would it keep on dropping the yields in those long-dated bonds? I think your graphs imply that, a normal shape. Remember, if you go back, I could probably talk to you a bit better, but...
Where are we?
So were you... One of your first ones where you show that as you go...
This chart.
There's that chart, which implies the limiting unconditional forward rate is sort of above whatever spots. And as you go further back, you'll see most of your yield curves are actually inverted up to the 30 years, and then you have your assumption after that. That would imply, I guess, if you just extrapolate that, you'd actually should be keep on going further down, maybe. Is that because... Well, how do you explain that inversion compared to maybe a long-term...
Okay, so there is another slide in the full pack which shows it's a really good question, which shows how applying this methodology to these curves, what it produces in terms of extrapolated yield curve shapes. And we see we have our kind of limiting assumption here, 5.5% currently, and there's some debate about where you should fix that number. And to be brutally honest, I think the most important thing for the purposes of insurance groups over the long term is we establish a clear, consistent assumption and stick with it. But they're bringing these curves, all of these curves into line with the limiting rate. So the forward rate at 80 or 90 years would be, the variation in extrapolated rates would be much smaller than in the diagram shown here. And there's an example of that in the full slide pack. I think it does pose important questions when we look at these curves. Very often we have forward rates that are substantially lower than what most kind of analysts would view as reasonable expectations for the short term rate. I think we've had sterling rates of forward rates of 1% over the last few years, and I don't think any independent forecaster would say that was a fair guess at short rates. So it's implying a substantial negative risk premium. In other words, investors are prepared to buy long bonds at substantially lower expected returns than rolling a cash account because they provide a match, or presumably, I think we'd all argue, because they provide a match for long-term insurance liabilities and pensions liabilities. There simply isn't enough long-term paper around. So one of the things we're implicitly doing when we extrapolate towards a long-term forward rate with a risk premium in it is we're saying implicitly, yes, there are these negative risk premia over the traded curve, but as we extend to ultra-long horizons, presumably beyond the term at which insurance companies have cash flows, somehow those forward rates revert back to some normal natural level which incorporates a risk premium. Now, not everyone agrees with that view. There's a school of thought that says you should just take that risk premium out. Your forward rate shouldn't include a risk premium, either positive or negative. There's also a discussion around risk margins that are built into valuations of, pure insurance risks, where we make sort of best estimates and then build risk margins on top based on the amount of capital that's required to cover a 99.5th percentile event. There's a debate about whether that should be applied for market unhedgeable risks and overlaid on top of any yield curve extrapolation. And the question, the really interesting question for me is how much of that risk margin is already contained in the extrapolations that we've got, and how much should in principle be added in on top. And it feels to me that if we're adding something in on top, then we got the answer to the question wrong first time through, so we ought to adjust our extrapolation method. But I think there is some careful thinking required about what's the risk premium in the market where you're extrapolating from, what are you saying about the ultimate position, and is what you're saying over the intermediate space credible and reasonable.
So I think you're in the camp that this negative risk premium that you sort of observe here sort of turns to a positive one as you go further out. Is that what you're kind of that camp?
Yeah. That's what we've done. But that could be a long, you know, it could be a long horizon before, if you like, we reach that point.
Hi, Heather Navid. I've been on the receiving end of lots of your scenarios in my UK life, and they're all incredibly complicated. And obviously, the UK market, the bonds go out for a lot longer, the government bonds, and you guys have spent a lot of time figuring out how to extrapolate. Given a bond market where the government bonds go out to 10 years, and given about a 3 or 4 month time frame to get a QIS in for the new capital regulations, how would you go about extrapolating our government bond rate, bond curve over here?
Well, I'd use exactly the same methodology, but what we do in Australia is we have the government bond yields, but we also have information from swap markets. So, I mean, if essentially, you can either just do this piece of work completely independently as if that information weren't there, or you can say, well, actually, we can observe swap rates to longer horizons. Can we set a path for the government bond yield which is consistent with what we can observe in government bond markets out to 10, 12 years, whatever it is, but also, if you like, respects the information that we have from Australian dollar swap markets as well. So...
And how consistent are those two curves in the UK out to the sort of measurable durations?
There's no, if you like, if that question phrased differently is there a constant swap spread over traded maturities? Sure. The answer is no. Those spreads do vary. So I think the answer we're giving to the calibration question in market, Australia is really interesting because you have this big difference between the maturity of longest swaps and longest government bonds. So we're using an assumption, and yes, it does embed an assumption about the effectively the spread being constant over that phase, which is relatively long in Australia compared to other markets. And yes, that isn't always what we see everywhere. But we think it's a better assumption than allowing the extrapolation method just to take over from the longest traded point where we get paths that I think are harder to defend. It's the old modelling problem. Choose the least bad solution. So I don't think there was another question, wasn't there?
Just one very quick one. Mike Barker, last year the Bank of England came out with its quantitative easing programme and the gilt curve dropped quite a lot overnight. Did you try and make any adjustment for that in your models, or did you just assume that was part of normal market movement?
Yes, I mean, the stochastic models are not normally attempting to provide a kind of explanation for individual market movements, so we would recalibrate our models to that initial position. We've not made any change to this, if you like, these very long-term assumptions that guide extrapolation. And I, you know, that feels right to me. Unless the world changes in a completely fundamental way, given that the calibrations of the ultimate rates are to, you know, very long-term data observed over, you know, 100 years or more, I'd take a lot of persuading to start fiddling around with those. I guess the one thing we always ask is, was that move within the sort of bounds that our models had set for the distribution of rate changes? And I think it was. So but it's time up. Time's up.
Okay, well, thank you, everyone. If you'd just like to join me in thanking John.